This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Oil's not the only commodity game in town, you know. We could get all esoteric and talk about pork bellies and soybean meal, but it's the workaday things that matter to you and me. Stuff that shows up more in what we buy, grains and metals. Just like oil, those prices are slipping too. What we don't know yet is when that's going to trickle down to us. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Areva, solutions for producing CO2-free energy and transmitting and distributing electricity, online at us.areva.com. And by Cleveland Clinic, working to redefine healthcare and the patient experience with the new Miller Family Pavilion and Glickman Tower. More at meetthebuildings.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Wednesday, the 3rd of September. Good, as always, to have you with us. Oil fell again today. That's five off days in a row for crude, in case you're counting. Corn dropped, soybeans are off, copper's down more than 7% over the past week. So you can imagine it's a tricky time for investors who are loaded down with commodities and for companies that run those kinds of investments, too. Companies like Osprey Management, it's a hedge fund manager in New York. This week it said it's going to close down one of its flagship funds after some big bets in the commodities markets went very, very bad. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more on the long rise of commodities and the quick fall.
The demise of a commodities hedge fund isn't exactly kitchen table news for most people, but analyst Edward Meir with MF Global says investors of all stripes should take note. Commodities are a volatile business.
It was all the rage earlier this year. Everybody was saying you had to buy commodities or commodity-related investments, and I think it just got ahead of itself.
The recent declines may hurt investors who got caught up in the frenzy. The Osprey Fund lost 27% of its value in August. But the sharp retreat of commodity prices should spell some relief for those of us who buy everything from gasoline to food to razor blades. You've already seen that at the gas pump. Analyst Ali DeBage follows consumer products companies for Sanford Bernstein. He says mostly because of higher oil and materials prices, consumers are paying about 14% more for food and household products than they were a few years ago. But he doesn't expect prices to come down anytime soon.
Part of the reason is just the uncertainty in the marketplace right now about oil prices. It's very volatile, and I'm not sure manufacturers want to, frankly, put themselves at risk, nor the retailers want to, if the volatility of the oil prices push it up or down in any one direction at this point.
Eventually, economists say lower commodity prices will take a bite out of inflation. But the forces behind the declines could hurt consumers in other ways. Demand is falling in part because of the global economic slowdown, and that could continue to hit U.S. jobs and incomes. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Today's auto sales figures confirm that nowhere is being hit harder economically than Detroit. Almost everybody was down. General Motors and Ford more than 20%. Even Toyota lost ground. Nissan was the only winner there. Officials at a Chinese juice company called Huiyuan are probably enjoying a Coke and a smile right now, a really big smile. Today, Coca-Cola offered almost $2.4 billion for the company. The all-cash deal comes with a hyper-caffeinated premium, too. It's worth three times Huiyuan's closing price this past Friday. It would be the biggest foreign takeover ever of a Chinese company, but regulators in Beijing might take the fizzle out of the deal. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports now from North Carolina Public Radio.
China is already Coke's fourth largest market, but with commodity prices rising and carbonated soda sales flat, this acquisition would give Coke a stronger foothold in the global marketplace. Greg Warren's an equity research analyst with Morningstar.
Based on the early reports, it looks like combined they'll have about 40% of the Chinese juice market rather.
stepped up.
That would let the company practically name its price for fruit and other ingredients. Warren says the jaw-dropping offer price may be too high. But other analysts point out China's juice market is growing at 15% a year. Consultant Tom Perko with Bevmark says that's because of China's expanded middle class.
There's just so much more disposable income, and when you can't breathe the air, you begin to think of your health, so you start thinking about fruit juice.
Perko says Coke's timing right after the Olympics is ideal. Our own reporter Scott Tong says Coke was the real winner of the Games.
Coca-Cola owned the place. You couldn't buy a drink from any other company in the entire Olympics complex.
The sponsorship bought Coke some goodwill, but it might not be enough to overcome China's antitrust and brand protection laws. Donald Strausheim is with Roth Capital Partners.
Just because Coke is a well-known name, and just because they sponsored the Olympics, is not going to count for much when the bureaucrats review this deal.
That review process is expected to take months. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
There are times when the Federal Reserve tells you something you kind of already know. Today's one of them. The Fed's beige book came out today. Its look at the U.S. economy by region. The words weak, soft, and subdued were used quite a bit. They did say, though, that lower gas prices have helped a bit. After decades of seeing its designs turned into fashion statements, think bomber jackets and cargo pants here, the U.S. Army has decided to enter the branding fray itself. It has decided to license the use of its marks and insignias by partnering with Sears to make an Army-inspired clothing line. The first Infantry Division collection launches next month. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
This Army line of clothing is more than sweatshirts with U.S. Army slapped across the chest. Amy Diamond is Sears fashion director. She says take the new collection's wool officer's coat.
Colors and the cut and the buttons, every single detail in it is coming directly from an archived heritage piece from the U.S. Army. So, you know, there is a great deal of authenticity to it, a lot of attention to detail.
She says the Army is determined its branded clothing will be as close to the original article as possible, and she thinks customers will respond to that. Kevin Keller agrees. He teaches marketing and branding at Dartmouth College. He says Sears and the Army have similar target markets, and he says Sears has other initiatives aimed at helping military families.
In the past, I think they have been very patriotic and very supportive, so there's sort of a natural alignment in terms of image as well as target.
As for why the Army is parading down the catwalk now, Keller says its traditional marketing campaigns aren't working the way they used to.
This may be seen as just one thing to make sure that they, you know, create some positives and out in the marketplace that would help its recruitment, because it's going to be, I think, challenging going forward to be as effective as they have been in the past.
Anything the Army can do to make a statement is good, he says. Even a fashion statement. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Wall Street eked out a win today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Today, the International Monetary Fund announced it's made a deal with some of the richest companies in the world. You might have heard of some of them. China, Dubai and Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates, Singapore. Yes, I know they're countries, not companies in the conventional sense, but the four of them and about two dozen other governments around the world control somewhere between $2 and $3 trillion in their sovereign wealth funds. Huge pools of investment capital, really. And after 6 months of negotiations with the U.S. and the Europeans, they have agreed on a set of best practices on how to spend that money. A branch of one of the biggest, the Abu Dhabi Fund, has decided to go Hollywood with some of its cash, $1 billion over 5 years to produce and distribute feature films. Ali Jafar is with Variety in London. Good to talk to you.
Thanks very much for having me.
Tell me about the company that's doing the investing here, the Abu Dhabi Media Company.
Yeah, well, the Abu Dhabi Media Company was launched last year in the wake of the kind of billion-dollar deal forged between Abu Dhabi and Warner Brothers on various content production and also kind of real estate deals to essentially become the holding umbrella company for all of Abu Dhabi's media operations. So that encompasses the Warner Brothers deal, it encompasses Abu Dhabi TV, the various kind of radio and print entities which Abu Dhabi is increasingly launching. And out of that now comes Image Nation, which is a kind of $1 billion funded production company, which will be seeking alliances with some of the best U.S. and international film companies.
Obviously, they've got the oil money to do it with, but $1 billion is still a whole lot of money. What are their risk rewards as they go forward?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing to say is that it's smart money. They are certainly not just throwing the cash around because they have it. They want to see a return on their investment. They want there to be a sustainable business plan. But I think beyond that, because they have that kind of liquidity, particularly at a time when you know, you've got the credit crunch, you've got the U.S. and European economy slowing down, hedge funds kind of retreating from investing in the entertainment industries, they have a surfeit of equity and cash to invest. And they want to bring content production. They want to bring a knowledge economy and diversify their own investment portfolios, which is exactly where the kind of film business and TV business comes in.
Are they going to take all that production knowledge and take it to Abu Dhabi and UAE, or are they going to do production all over the world?
Oh, I think this is not an exclusive Abu Dhabi deal or UAE deal. It's not as if every film will either be filmed in Abu Dhabi or the UAE or have a kind of Arab Middle Eastern theme or subject matter. I think what they do hope is, you know, on those productions, even if it's filmed in the US, filmed in Europe, that they'll be able to take, you know, local Emiratis, local Arabs, to work on the film, to gain kind of production knowledge, and eventually in the hope that they can come back and make their own films and tell their own stories and build up an industry that way.
Obviously, other financial institutions have tried to get into the Hollywood game, Wall Street hedge funds and some of the big investment banks. This is an investment along those lines, right?
They're not doing this to lose money. But I think there is almost a more profound aspect to this, which is they want to kind of fast-track the development of the media and particularly film industries in the UAE. So I think because they've been so successful in other areas, whether it's real estate, turning their Emirates into a kind of financial hub, tourism increasingly, they also now want to fast track that film industry, which, you know, 20, 30 years ago was non-existent.
What's your considered opinion as to whether or not this is going to succeed? They've been able to do it with real estate. Dubai's been able to do it with financial services. What about this?
No, I mean, look, the first thing to say is they've got a lot of smart people working on this deal. They're certainly working with the cream of the crop. You don't get bigger than Warner Brothers, for example, and I'm sure that the other companies that we hear about when they announce them in the coming days and weeks will be of a certain value and a certain prestige. But the film business is a risky one. You can make a film like Dark Knight, which makes $500 million, and you can make a film like Speed Racer, which makes a fraction of that. And both of those films are Warner Brothers films.
You mentioned the name of this company, Image Nation. How's it going to be branded when those credits roll? Is it going to be Image Nation by Abu Dhabi?
I would imagine, if you go to any film nowadays, I mean, sometimes you get 5-6 logos hitting you before the film starts. So I'm sure they've got one more logo to stick on the screen now.
Ali Jafar is a foreign correspondent for Variety. We reached him in London. Sir, thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
It's going to be a big night for Republicans in St. Paul. Their vice presidential nominee, Sarah Palin, is going to take the podium. And we are going to take this opportunity to look at some GOP policies. While the convention's on, we've asked some Republicans to tell us where they think their party can do better. Commentator David Frum says they ought to start with immigration.
Since the year 2000, more than 10 million people have migrated to the United States, the majority of them illegally, most of them very poorly skilled. That's on top of the nearly 30 million who arrived between 1970 and 2000. Again, most of them poorly skilled. Here's what the National Research Council has to say about the economic effect of such a mass migration. If the wages of domestic unskilled workers did not fall, no domestic worker, unskilled or skilled, would gain or lose, and there would be no net domestic gain from immigration. The fiscal impact, what immigration does to government spending and taxes, is even more troubling than the economic impact. Take, for example, North Carolina, a state that has recently become an immigration magnet. In 1995, the state estimated it spent only about $10 million educating the children of illegals. 10 years later, $210 million. Illegal immigrants don't qualify for many federal benefits, but they do use schools, they do use roads, they do use hospitals, and they do use jails. And all of these are paid for by state and local property taxes that fall much more heavily on the middle class than does the federal income tax. Suppose the United States adopted an immigration policy like Canada's or Australia's, one that favored high-skilled immigrants who could earn their way out of poverty and whose families would contribute more in taxes than they consumed in benefits. Immigration would still redistribute wealth. It would just redistribute it from top to bottom. Today's policy redistributes from bottom to top and taxes the middle to pay the adjustment costs. And what do we Republicans say? Our nominee wants to make the problem worse. He supports a big new guest worker program to import even more low-skilled workers and an amnesty to legalize those already here. We've had enough faith-based policy. If our party is to rejoin reality, it's time to start with some reality on immigration.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. His latest book is called Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again. We are always interested in what you have to say. Online is best for us. Go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says contact. Coming up, facing foreclosure as kids head back to school.
I've seen it happen an awful lot. My sister stayed downstairs from me, and she had to move, so she in the same process I'm in.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained 15 points today, a tenth of 1% to close at 11,532. The NASDAQ lost 15 points, two-thirds percent, finished at 2,333. The S&P 500 shaved off 2 points, that is two-tenths percent, closed at 1,274. Tech-related stocks took many of the hits. Shares in Corning shattered after the maker of glass for flat-screen TV said third-quarter earnings would suffer from slower TV sales. The stock lost more than 12%. Microsoft deleted three-quarters of 1% on fears that Google's new browser that we told you about yesterday take the shine off Microsoft's Internet Explorer. Rising commodity prices took the pop out of food giant ConAgra. Shares in the company behind Orville Redenbacher's you-know-what lost more than 8% today. European markets were down. Britain's FTSE lost more than 2%. Germany's DAX traded down three-quarters of 1%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note was at 3.7%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. Every day's Marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases second quarter productivity figures. Are Americans shopping for back-to-school gear? The nation's chain stores report monthly sales. And AARP parties in Washington at its 50th anniversary celebration. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Amid the so-so beige book and auto news we talked about up at the top of the program, there is a housing bright spot worth mentioning. Freddie Mac had no problem at all unloading $3 billion worth of new debt this morning, and they did it without having to pay outrageous interest rates either. That's a pretty reliable sign the market's confidence in the government-sponsored mortgage company and its sibling Fannie Mae is growing. Yale economist Robert Shiller has been watching the real estate market for a long time now. He's the Shiller in the S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index. He's also the author of a new book called The Subprime Solution. Since that would be a pretty popular thing to have right about now, I asked him how he'd do it.
Well, in the short term, we have to do the kinds of things that the government has already done. They don't call it a bailout, but they are supporting by offering FHA insurance to defaulting homeowners. And I think that they did the right thing, but I think that it's not enough. No more than 400,000 people will be helped by those. But I think that the more important thing is to think about the long run. The solutions that we've seen happening lately look kind of ad hoc and kind of after the fact.
You know, Ben Bernanke has a phrase he likes to use when he talks about the government stepping in and doing something about subprimes. He says, you know, we have to be careful to avoid the moral hazard.
make the argument for me of putting government money at risk to bail out some of these banks and some of these people who made not very wise decisions.
We oversold, basically, including Ben Bernanke, oversold this market. People were told by our president, George Bush, that it's wonderful. The homeownership is rising. No warning about what could go wrong. If we let these people just fail and get thrown out of their house, you know, there's some bad faith there. And I think that this is America. We stand for each other. We are a unified country. We don't let that happen. Unfortunately, it's messy. You know, I don't like to be in this situation. The long-term solutions I propose in the book are to prevent us from getting into this situation again.
Well, lay out the steps for me then as to what we do in the long term to prevent this from happening again.
Well, I have three main things. One is to improve the financial information infrastructure. Secondly, is to improve the breadth and scope of our markets. And thirdly, we need to invent new retail financial products that involve ordinary people, the broad mass of people, into sophisticated risk management.
Well, let me get you to that point about financial innovation, and I can't be the first person who's mentioned this to you, sir, but the way we got into this mess was by a lot of smart people on Wall Street trying to get really innovative with the finances.
Well, one very important development that occurred since 1990 is the development of the subprime mortgage. And that had some very significant effects. It raised the homeownership rate from around 65% to almost 70%. And it seemed to be an advance. We had found a way to get lower-income people. Unfortunately, it didn't work out as planned. I don't think we'll want to throw out all of that thinking. I think we want to move forward.
So how do we do it right?
Well, one proposal that I have in my book is what I call a continuous workout mortgage. And that is a mortgage whose terms adjust automatically to changes in the economic situation. The mortgage contract lowers your balance if home prices fall, so it protects you against price falls. This is very basic. It's the same sort of thing that corporations do. They make swaps or forward agreements to protect them against some price moving against them that would harm their business. I want to democratize that and make it available to everyone.
Robert Shiller is professor of economics at Yale. His most recent book is called The Subprime Solution. Professor Shiller, thanks a lot for your time, sir.
It's a great pleasure.
Unless and until Professor Shiller's ideas take hold, the housing market is still hurting. Add in the cost of gas and rising prices at the grocery store, and the ripple effects are spreading. In a lot of communities, schools are among the first places to feel the fallout. Some are reporting spikes in the number of homeless students this fall. In this second of our back-to-school stories, Mari Saito from WCPN in Cleveland reports on how those districts and their students are coping.
Akron school bus drivers are meeting in a high school cafeteria to talk logistics. Last winter, their department hit a record. On any given day, nearly one-third of Akron's 78 school buses were out picking up homeless students at shelters, motels, or relatives' and friends' houses. So this year, Transportation Coordinator Kathy Keel is getting ready.
Every bus is available for shelter transport, where we think at this point, you know, we have to earmark a few until we see how things work out.
In 1 year, Akron Public Schools saw a 25% jump in the number of homeless students. Deborah Mantegi works with homeless students in that district.
Back in the 80s, there was a lot we heard about homelessness, and it kind of disappeared. But it's emerging again because of the economy, this foreclosure crisis, credit card debt, and even some breakdown of the family.
Up the road in Cleveland, homeless advocates say evictions of low-income renters from foreclosed properties boosted the number of students without a permanent address by more than 30% last year. Brian Davis heads the Northeast Ohio Coalition for the Homeless.
It's usually somebody who is
living in a duplex or a multifamily apartment building that's been foreclosed on. And usually the tenant is the last to know in the whole process. They have usually a short period of time to relocate and have then trouble finding a place to live.
One such homeless tenant is Cleveland resident Clarice Hicks. While waiting for an after-school reading session for her children, the mom of four told me lots of people are in the same situation.
I've seen it happen an awful lot. My sister stayed downstairs from me, and she had to move, so she in the same process I'm in.
Hicks and her kids are now sleeping on the floor at the homes of friends and relatives. Elizabeth Hins at Minneapolis Public Schools sees a lot of people like this these days. Federal aid helps her district with these homeless students, but Hins says it's never been enough. Charities also help homeless students get school supplies, clothes, and backpacks. But now, Hins says, donations are dropping while the number of needy families is growing.
We won't necessarily have additional students in our school district, but the students who are experiencing this will certainly be living under great stress.
Deborah Rigsby is with the National School Boards Association. She says schools get federal aid for poor students, but local districts have to make up the gaps for growing demand as both food and gas costs rise. Many of these districts are already on a shoestring budget, and in some places, property taxes continue to fall because of the foreclosure crisis.
School districts are having to go back to revamp, to try to close budget gaps. Many school districts that may have contingency funds are having to use those reserves now.
Like Akron Public Schools. Halfway through last year, the district's homeless program ran out of bus money and had to dip into general funds to get homeless kids to class. Still, Akron's Deborah Mantegui says there are days when there aren't enough shelter beds and supplies to go around.
I had one call from a father, and they had a student that was at higher middle school, and they were desperate. They were living in their car, and I felt very badly that I was not able to help them.
Homeless advocates are pushing a $30 million emergency assistance bill now before Congress. The funding, they say, would help school districts buy school supplies and hire staff to help families and students cope with homelessness. I'm Mari Saito for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, 17-year-old Jamie Lynn Spears can't vote yet, and I don't know if the teenage television star is a Republican or a Democrat. But either way, she is reaching out to Sarah Palin's daughter, Bristol. Spears was in the news herself a couple of months ago after her pregnancy hit the tabloids. Now she's trying to make sure Bristol Palin is ready when the time comes. She has sent along a gift, $60 worth of burp cloths from a trendy Hollywood baby boutique. And that is the baby news, and it is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 15 points, a tenth of 1%. The Nasdaq fell 15 points, 2/3%. The S&P 500 slipped 2 points. That is 0.2% there. Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineer the program for us. Coming up next time, courts climbing mountains of disability claims.
It solves a lot of problems by just paying a case. The individual claimant is out of the system. In other words, there are no appeals.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.